P.S. I Love Hoffman is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For all things Cage Club related, head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
Brian, how do you like the cider we're having? It's quite scrumptious.
We are drinking cider. I never thought of cider as scrumptious, but we are drinking cider.
It's refreshing.
It's a little creepy that you're talking to me in that accent. Why do we always get these movies where we're forced to do these cheesy accents?
I love doing accents. I don't know. I mean, this is, how many Southern... Did this make you think of the Yearling?
A little, but not really.
But we are drinking cider. Is this only the second time? I know White Russians for Big Lebowski.
There's been other times that, like, we've had alcohol, but nothing crazy. We don't get too smashed.
But this just happened. I brought back a delightful cider from Vermont. Which is in the north, because the north won.
Yes, they did. But today, we'll be transporting you to the south.
Iggy Pop! Amen! Let it rock!
I'm a fucking idiot.
Red meat, we crave sustenance.
I'm an artist.
Hello, my name is Jimmy Cody.
It's fun to have some fun.
Fun!
Tommy?
It's okay, Pink.
Whoever she is, I'm gonna find her and I'm gonna hurt her.
I've spent the past 3 years learning Finnish!
I'm always home, I'm on cool.
This is a process of dehypnotization.
Shut up!
Hey Hoff fans, welcome to this week's edition of the P.S. I Love Hoffman podcast, our love letter to the remarkable career of the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman. I'm Brian Rodriguez.
And I'm Kyle Reinfried.
We're always home, we're always on cool, we're always ready to talk great movies.
Great movies, epic movies.
Today, we do have an epic.
That's, like, the epic, this is the time, like, it came back. Like, it came back in the 90s, right?
Yeah, not with this film, though, certainly.
No, I mean, this is 2003.
Yeah, 2003. Oh, the film is Cold Mountain.
Cold Mountain. Sorry, I always
yeah,
do
we always,
that.
Sometimes we'll go 10 minutes without saying the film.
Yeah.
We're just so excited to talk about it.
I really enjoyed this movie. It's a long movie. 2 hours and 34 minutes.
Yeah, no. And it feels long, too, it doesn't. As epics do.
Yes.
Is it like, oh, a quick watch?
Do you think, so after this, was looking through the epics, and there's a loose, like, way of saying epics, you know, or categorizing epics, I should say, because today, like, even more recent epics, this is 2003, I saw, like, some people including... Obviously, well, Star Wars started in 77, but they're saying, like, Star Wars Now is obviously including that. One person even said, like, 300. Like, 300 is not an epic to me. It derives from a time of epic tales.
Yeah, like okay, I think epic probably comes from, like...
Well, it came from, like, the Iliad and all
but
that.
No, but, like, the Latin, like, epoch. Like,
yeah.
like an epoch. Like, E-P-O-C-H. Like a time period.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not... But I don't think epics always have to take place... in the past.
No.
But it just feels more epic-ish.
Yeah, so like reading up on what epics, you know, tends to be like sprawling ensembles, beautiful scenery, like a lot of locations, the costumes play a big part of it.
When I see epics, I also think there's a level of like melodrama involved.
Yeah.
Like to me, there's not really...
Torn lovers.
Comedy epics.
No.
There can be, I suppose, but that's
Monty
not what
Python
I...
and the Holy Grail.
Or like On the Road Again, Bob Hope things.
Love
On but the Road. But does that feel like an epic to you?
No.
Like, I think epics. Mm. And it's funny because some epics do really, really well and some epics do poorly. It seems like what people say the worst movies of all time, not necessarily worst movies of all time, but like the biggest disappointments of all time, box office-wise, have been epics like Troy, for example.
What was that other one? Kingdom of Heaven.
Kingdom of Heaven, which is not that bad of a film.
I suppose I never saw this version, but supposedly the director's cut is like really good.
I think that's the version I saw, and it's not terrible. It's actually pretty good. What's the one with Pocahontas? Not Pocahontas. It has New World, I think it's called. Yeah, these are like epics.
It's like Colin Farrell. Colin,
I was going to say Colin Firth. No, but Colin Farrell. These are epics that did not do well.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of them that come... Alexander is a good one. Not a good one. But
so while going back and looking at the genre of epics, like I said, it kind of came back in the 90s. I think it really started with Dances with Wolves,
That's what,
which won Best Picture over Goodfellas.
You know what's You know, it's another epic of that era, though, that wasn't, like, Oscar-y, but it has a huge Oscar guy. Last of the Mohegans.
Oh, yeah.
Daniel Day-Lewis is the person I'm referring to.
I love the music. Oh, and like, I'm going to get into it later. I mean, it's just in the beginning of the film, but I always tend to love, like, my favorite character is, like, the Native American character. If it's, like, a small role, like, in Wind Talkers.
Well, I feel, and that should not have been as small as it was in that film.
No.
Native American role. But I feel like a lot of it, they do have cool Native American roles. Like, from this era to nowadays? From, like, Dances with Wolves to nowadays?
Even in Wonder Woman, they included, like, a Native American as part of, like, her...
And role. I think it's, like, a feel-bad for all the Westerns. Where, like, Native Americans just slaughtered. Because, honestly, we should feel bad with the Native Americans.
Of course, yeah.
They're the most special people in the world.
Yeah, definitely. This film just, like, shows the horrors on both sides. Actually, I almost tend to say it shows, like... The Northerners and you got Ray Winstone as like our main antagonist and he's from the South, but definitely doesn't show Union soldiers in like a nice, you know, easy way.
No,
it shows the horrors of war.
Exactly. And at this point in the war, we're so late in the war that nobody's happy.
No, they just like, there's that, it's not, it's not, I was going to say an ongoing joke. Not an ongoing joke.
I wouldn't call this a joke film.
No, but there's the ongoing, like, that they say when the war starts. It's like, oh, we'll be back in a month. And then, like, later on the film, it's revisited. And, and someone says, oh, it's going to be over in a month. And she's like, that's what you said 3 years ago.
Yeah. And just to be clear, we're talking about the Civil War. I don't know if we said that yet.
Yeah, so Cold Mountain.
Yeah, what's Cold Mountain about, Kyle? Tell us. Tell our Hoff fan audience.
Well, here we go. In this Civil War epic, young love is torn apart by the ravages of war. It captures the horrors for both the fighting and those left behind at home. Both Inman, played by Jude Law, and Ada, played by Nicole Kidman, grow and change through the years and experiences while apart, but there's always hope that these sweethearts will reunite at Cold Mountain.
Which is the town they're from.
Yes, so there is a Cold Mountain, North Carolina. It's not a town.
No.
But there is, like, a mountain. But, you know, it's pretty interesting. This film was filmed mostly in Romania.
Yeah, I read that, too. And
the Carpathian Mountains.
You know where I hear the Carpathian thing from? Viggo the Carpathian is the painting in Ghostbusters 2. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Kyle, because I didn't do too much research on this film. Yes, I'm a very good host, I know. But... correct me if I'm wrong, they shot a lot in Romania and Eastern Europe because they said Appalachia, this takes place in like Appalachian North Carolina, that Appalachia now did not look as rustic as Eastern Europe does now in terms of like telephone poles and highways.
Yeah, there's just way too much. I've driven through that area, through like the Smoky Mountains and everything like that, and it's just pretty
still
know,
beautiful, but it's definitely beautiful, 21st century.
But yeah, I forget what the budget ended up being for this movie, but I thought you know, recently we had the episode with Amos Poe and we were talking some technical stuff, so I thought this was appropriate and you'd appreciate this because of just again how long the movie was. And some people, I really enjoyed it. I could understand some people think it like drags, but again, that's just the way of the epic tale.
Epics just generally drag.
Yeah, but so this was shot in a 60:1 ratio. Okay, so like widescreen is like 16:9 to give like anybody like a basic idea. But 60:1
fractions, which I paid attention more.
But a 60:1 ratio. But so this is what that means. It means for every minute on screen, which again, this movie is 2 hours and 34 minutes. For every minute on screen, there's 60 minutes of footage. So times 2 hours and 34 minutes.
Wait, how does that make sense? There's 60 minutes of footage for every minute?
Yeah.
That's crazy. Wow, that's a good fact. I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
So you mentioned...
And this also spent, like, that was the whole thing. Like, when reading trivia, I just saw a lot of time-related stuff, which, again, for the epic, just makes, like, it just makes it, like, funnier that way. And so they spent 5 years on this film, 1 year alone used for editing. Like, I'm sorry, when I say they, I'm sorry, Anthony...
yeah, I was going to say the director.
Minghella.
Anthony Minghella is the same director as...
Talented Mr. Ripley.
Another Philip Seymour Hoffman film.
Which we also get James Rehborn in this movie for a slight second as
yeah,
a director.
Slightly.
Yeah.
And, of course, Jude Law.
Yeah.
So weird thing.
Well, he's probably, according to this, like an hour of footage, but it's only a minute.
So weird thing, right? Okay,
and
so...
Jude Law, yeah.
He obviously, the director, and the director was heavily involved in this film,
mm-hmm.
worked super hard on this film for years.
Yes.
Yet, it surprised a lot of people. The budget was $79 million, which is a lot, but not crazy a lot.
No, at one time it was like the budget was like being said that it was maybe going to be $125.
So I don't know how they got under budget.
No, that
never happens. And they made $173 million, and it was actually a sleeper hit and a surprise film of that year.
This was nominated for so many things. It was
nominated
for... Jude Law was nominated. Renee Zellweger won for Best Supporting Actress. And I'm saying when I say nominations, this is for the Oscars.
Oscars, yes. We're not talking about BAFTAs
or Golden Globes.
Or MTV Movie Awards.
Nominated for Best Music.
Kids' Choice
Score,
Awards.
Editing and cinematography. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
That's six categories right there alone. And let me tell you one thing, and I know you'll appreciate this. So I read in, you know, trivia that it won, again, for original best score, but then best original song.
And there was two
songs
nominated.
Nominated.
There was two songs nominated. I like the music here. I don't know how you felt
about
this
whole movie is very, it's got a very music-driven feel to it. But I got really excited, and I even watched, like, when rewatching this, and you can watch it on Amazon Prime, and I stayed throughout, like, left the whole credits on, because, you know, like, when there's, obviously in, like, Titanic, there's My Heart Will Go On, but then there's the, like, vocal version playing through the credits. Here, I read in the trivia, it said original song nominated, and it was by Sting. And so that got me really excited because I know one of our favorite songs of all time is from The Three Musketeers. What is it? All for One and One for Love?
Yeah.
All for one and one for love.
And you always bring that up because, like, that was... We're talking about the Disney Three Musketeers.
Yeah.
With Charlie
Sheen.
Right?
Charlie
Sheen,
Oliver Platt, and...
Which I love Oliver Platt. We're big Oliver Platt
Donald
guys.
Sutherland.
Donald Sutherland.
And Chris O'Donnell as... Tim Curry's also in
Tim
it.
Tim Curry. Great cast, but...
Yeah.
Before anything in the credits appear, it's to push this song.
Yeah.
And, okay, so that's what I don't understand, right? Like, they act like this movie's a sleeper hit, but clearly they were trying to push this soundtrack.
But it isn't by Sting, it's by this woman named Krausting.
Oh, okay. Okay,
it's
whatever.
Like, yeah, so I got really excited for nothing. But it's a beautiful song, and it plays in the credits.
And who does the soundtrack? I saw a familiar name.
It's, again, T-Bone.
Oh, T-Bone Burnett.
Yeah.
Who, True Detective.
Yeah.
Season one, like, that freaking song still haunts me. Oh, that intro is so good. But,
he's just awesome. He works with the Coen Brothers a lot.
Yeah, he works with the Coen Brothers a lot. But we have, speaking of, I want to go through the cast pretty soon. But speaking of music, one of the songs was Jack White's song, and Jack from mm-hmm. the White Stripes, and
yeah.
Now most people just know Jack White is Jack White now.
Yeah.
But he's in the film.
That was a pretty nice little role, you know?
Part was originally offered
Georgia.
To Ryan Adams. But Jack White took it, which is a lot better. Kyle, tell us a little bit about this cast. I just want to go through... This is going to take a while to go through this epic cast.
I don't
even remember seeing all these people in this
movie. I'm not even going to, like, read their character names because the list will just be that. I'm just going to say all these actors that are in this movie.
I might stop you.
So you've got Jude Law.
He's the star. He's the main guy here. He's W.P. Inman. And we should say his name.
Yeah, so, yeah, W.P. Inman is played by Jude Law. And then his love interest is Ada Monroe, played by Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
And so...
This is their story.
100%. And then, but on, like, the cover and then credits before, like, the whole, rolling credits and everything, the three names are Jude Law, Nicole Kidman, and Renee Zellweger.
Well, she won the Oscar.
She won the
Oscar.
And
she brings it. She really does.
Awesome in this movie. So her name is Ruby...
Anyone who wants to ever, like, throw shade on her for, like, oh, Bridget Jones.
Watch this movie.
Like, yeah, proof that she can bring
like,
it.
Even someone could, like, I know we've talked about this movie at least on one or two episodes, but Jerry Maguire, like, you know, very big movie, like, you know, like, a loved movie that she's in. But someone could, obviously, that's, like, the Tom Cruise show. This is, like, this role she owns.
It's not the Renee Zellweger show, but she... Like, it's not...
Every scene she's in, she steals.
She's amazing in this movie. She's great. This is... I can't think of a better thing she's ever done, a better role she's ever done.
Then you have Brendan Gleeson, obviously our main man, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Natalie Portman, Giovanni Ribisi, Donald Sutherland, Ray Winstone, James Rebhorn, as you said, also Jack White, then you've got Ethan Suplee, and then you have, like, these even, I didn't, like, write their names down, but when it gets to their scenes, I have so many names.
Ethan Suplee's, like, the guy from, like, Boy Meets World and Remember the Titans.
And, yeah, what's, I feel
like... the big guy,
yeah,
right, okay.
My Name is Earl.
My Name is Earl, yeah.
That's, like, a little bit more... he's still very big, and then he's lost... I met him, actually. Maybe I'll post that picture. I met him on the set of...
Oh, yeah, I've seen that picture.
...of Wolf of Wall Street. Him and Spike Jonze.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that now.
But that's just, like, this cast has so many...
Well, I don't know if you knew this guy, James Gammon. He's in the cast.
Okay, Major League.
Yeah,
the manager.
I was like,
awesome.
I was like, who's? I've seen this guy. I know this voice. Anyway, he's the manager in Major League.
And I've witnessed.
Which is awesome.
I don't have his wife, the actress that plays his wife in the movie, written down. I know her name's Sally, but
Kathy Baker is her
Kathy,
name.
But she's just in a bunch of stuff.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
And like we said, even
she's
like
an Emmy for
James,
something.
Just like we said, like James Rebhorn is just in like a quick like. He literally, I think he has two lines. He plays a doctor in a, it looks like an old estate that they turned into a little hospital for Confederate soldiers. And then the biggest one of the, I was trying to figure out the whole time, who is this guy playing? Because Charlie Hunnam is in it.
Hunnam.
Right?
Is it Hunnam or Hunnam? I've never known. I'm assuming
I don't,
Hunnam, but the Sons of Anarchy guy.
There's two N's in it, so I'm going to go with Hunnam.
Sons of Anarchy guy, right?
Sons of Anarchy guy, almost 50 Shades of Grey guy, Pacific Rim guy, but nowhere to be seen in Pacific Rim 2 trailer. He plays that, like, albino bad guy in, like, the posse with Ray Winstone.
And who becomes very pivotal at a later scene. Who did you said Giovanni Ribisi. You said Natalie Portman. I see Lucas Black.
Yeah, okay.
Who does he play? Because I don't remember seeing him in the film. But right? I see Lucas Black on the IMDb.
Lucas Black is someone we talk about a lot. Or not a lot, but like enough.
Well, we should pitch this, I guess, that the guys on Cage Club are doing a Fast and Furious.
Yeah, it was just the other... By the time this episode's released, it'll be like a week ago, I guess.
Yeah,
almost.
So cageclub.me. We have a lot of new shows for you.
A lot of new shows.
But...
Well, so they changed the podcast,
the Ben Affleck
Ben
one.
Ben Affleck
just
one, because
not the best time to do that.
Obviously, yeah, you've probably heard of Ben Affleck's recent tribulations.
But
worse than tribulations. Anyway, Charlize Theron they chose as a worthy replacement.
And you really like the title of this one, Watch the Theron.
Yeah.
But it's cool. No, and we're both going to be guests on that one. We can't say which movie is yet, but we're super excited.
I almost said it, but...
Nope, we're not allowed. But they're also announced a Ryan Gosling one.
I think I'll have a pretty mighty performance on it.
Joe Young. But the Ryan Gosling one and a Channing Tatum one.
And a Channing Tatum one.
And a Fast and Furious one. So any of you Fast and Furious fans out there, I know we get a lot of crossover with Cold Mountain and Fast and Furious.
Yeah, so
mainly
much.
Because of our guy Lucas Black here.
Lucas Black. So you didn't recognize who in the
Who is he in this film? Tell me.
In the beginning when we see Inman in like the trenches, he's like the one that he's trying to pull up out when he gets stabbed.
Oh, okay.
He's got like blonde hair.
Yeah, because he has blonde hair. That's
and then we see him, but he's just like... He actually, in this scene, he does look young. Like, that's the whole thing. He's like, oh, that's blah, blah, blah from, like, our town.
Yeah,
like,
okay.
Is he old enough to be even fighting in the war?
And then in Cold Mountain 2, he's going to be, like, 50.
Yeah.
And he's going to still play a young
guy.
He
died in Cold Mountain.
No. He's going to come back in a flashback.
As a Confederate.
Or Fast and Furious rules.
Shadow.
He just comes back.
He just comes back, yeah. Yeah, that's the Lucas Black is famous for...
At least in our minds.
Yeah, in our minds. For being in...
Tokyo Drift.
But then has a small role in the beginning of the sixth one. The sixth Fast and Furious, I think.
Yeah, it's after, like, it's just like a little coda to Han dying.
Yeah.
But he's, like, he's still supposedly a teenager, but he's...
But
like
he looks 40.
Which is fine, because he is.
Because he has a big forehead with wrinkles in it.
Because he's an older guy.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So, okay, so that's Lucas Black.
If you're ever angry at, like, Star Wars continuity or anything, just
watch. Yeah, but that movie is critic. Those movies are critic-proof, you know? Like,
ugh, Fast and Furious.
I didn't see the last one, but they're fun.
There's a lot of drama going on between Tyrese and The Rock.
Which is an amazing feud. And I just love that we live in a world in that feud, with that feud existing.
They're going to mend their, you know, their problems, and they're going to run together as president and vice president.
Other people in this film, Emily Deschanel.
Yeah.
She's in From Bones.
From Bones.
And the sister of Zooey Deschanel.
Yeah.
Who's been in another Hoffman film.
Yeah, she's in a small, she's in the same scene as, like, James Rebhorn. She just plays a...
Yeah.
Jenna Malone. She's also in a really quick part.
Who is she?
She's the person, she's the young girl that's trying to take Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, the fairy person.
The fairy person.
Yeah, I was wondering who that was, because I'm like, I know this face.
Yeah, Jenna Malone.
And what is she from? Where have I seen her?
So, well, the two biggest, I think, connections to us, Jenna Malone is in The Hunger Games, which obviously PSH is going to be in, and then Inherent Vice, so that's a nice little connection to
Hope,
PTA.
I think she's in that.
Right,
I remember.
She's Owen Wilson's wife.
Yeah. She did really good.
I mean, she's been around. She was a child actor. She was also in another movie. What was that? Nocturnal Animals, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
I also remember her in Into the Wild.
Oh, okay.
A little part in that film.
As far as epic genres go, they're so far not disappointing in the casting department.
No. Great cast. This is a Civil War movie, and it's not a high, like, moral Civil War movie, and it's not a big war movie. I like the side of war that this shows.
Well, again, it goes into, like, almost like my favorite Vietnam movie, Deer Hunter, which really, I mean, it shows, like, all, like, kind of, like, three stages of war before, while you're in it, and then, like, the aftermath and being back at home and how it changed your life. But this really shows also, like, kind of how I gave in my, you know, description, that it's very much showing. Cause, I mean, well, because it's the story of Ada and Inman, so you're really seeing what's going on back in this town and specifically on this one farm of Ada's. And then, obviously, Jude Law's experiences of fighting, and then once he decides to leave the hospital and, like, you know, I guess, what do you call it?
And becomes a deserter.
And deserter, yeah.
It's this narrative of war. And I know this is, by the way, this is an adaptation from a novel, mm-hmm. a pretty successful novel. I'm glad you brought up that Vietnam thing. I don't think this movie gets made and made so well without that era of Vietnam films. The Vietnam War, with the exception of movies like Hamburger Hill, which is an underrated film, but we'll discuss that in our Vietnam War podcast. The Vietnam War films had to be a little bit macabre, had to be a little bit realistic, had to be a little bit like, wow, war sucks. Because that war sucked, and let's be honest, all wars suck, but the United States lost.
Yeah.
Lost. So you have movies like, I mean, you brought up The Deer Hunter, but Platoon. Even Apocalypse Now is just, like, so dark.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
To an extent, Full Metal Jacket.
I was just going to say Full Metal Jacket.
And this is because that was a dark war and a very conflicting war. Obviously, the Civil War is, too. But a lot of times it is depicted as, like, a glorifying thing, but not necessarily.
Well, yeah, there's that, but, and then ultimately people go and say, like, well, this was what finally made us the United States of America. Yeah. So there's almost, like, the positive in the end, even through this bloodshed.
I like to bring up World War II. Everyone thinks the United States was on the right side of World War II, if you have a sound mind. You know?
Yeah, it was the ultimate good versus evil war.
So rarely do you get movies that paint World War II like a war. Mm-hmm. Like, wow, this fucking sucks. We're shooting people. We're in the mud. This sucks. I mean, Private Ryan tried to do it. There's still, like, an overall... Anything with Tom Hanks is going to make you smile at the end.
Yeah.
But there's like, some of that gore and some of that, why the hell are we here?
Yeah.
But think of all the World War II movies that took place before that. Holocaust one's not included. They're always, like, you know, like you said, good versus evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, get the people going.
Yeah, rah-rah kind of films. This movie is not that at all. This is the ugliness of war. This is, like you said, akin to the Vietnam films, where it's like, I'm here, how do I get out of this?
And it really starts off like right away in that, because I mean, you've got, well, there's a voiceover from Nicole Kidman, and then we go into the trenches, and it's the Confederate, you know, soldiers in their trench, and then we see that there's Union soldiers that are planting these giant barrels of explosives pretty much underneath them. And then right when they see a rabbit in the trenches and they're hoping to catch it for some dinner, there's this huge explosion. That's definitely where, like, I feel like a lot of the budget went to film, and then to the film stock, and then to this explosion.
Yeah, and this is actually a real battle.
Oh, okay, yeah. What was the name of the battle?
So it's called the Battle of the Crater.
Okay.
And, well, first of all, it's part of the Siege of Petersburg.
Yes, that's what
which was one of the final things, final sieges of the war. There's a lot of battles involved. This is actually a battle that the Union loses, because it's real. Like, I've heard of this battle, then I looked up some other stuff. They put, the engineers dug trenches under the battlefield.
Yeah. So when that explosion happened.
Yeah, like dynamite or whatever they had at the time, made a huge explosion to try to break the... it was trench warfare in the Battle of Petersburg. And it backfired for the Union, because I guess there was almost like too much explosives. Yeah. They didn't just break the cannons and such. It's called the Battle of the Crater because they made such a crater.
Yeah, they created this wall. And then what did the guys say? They're like, oh, it's like a turkey shoot, right?
Yeah, so there's a huge crater. The Union soldiers charge in, but they're actually now have the low ground because they're in the crater.
As we learned in Revenge of the Sith, if you have the high ground, you're just always... you're just good to go. Famously, Obi-Wan versus Anakin in their final battle on Mustafar.
And I have the high ground. Yeah, no, but in war, you 100% always want to take the high ground, and the Union put themselves at a disadvantage. And believe it or not, I don't know if you got this, Kyle, but it really reminded me of the Battle of the Bastards in Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah.
Where you just see the piles of bodies and the gruesomeness. And the people,
well, this is, that's the whole, okay, so again, it starts off with this, like, intensity. And
which I love.
And it just never, like, in your dreams, like, you think, like, war, yes, horrible, like, someone is killing somebody, but just the fact of when you see, like, the soldier running, tripping, and then soldiers, like, killing him by just running over him.
Yeah, so we don't want to go over, like, this movie, like, scene by scene, because we will be here for 3 or 4 hours.
Well, almost like last week with Owning Mahoney, there's a lot of quick scenes. It's not that there's a lot of quick scenes, but they're very, like, similar scenes in just the sense of that... like, I've got written, like, you know, that once we're in the past and we meet, Donald Sutherland plays Nicole Kidman's father. He's a reverend.
Yeah, he's a reverend who comes to the town.
From Charleston, because he's got a weak chest and the, you know.
Yeah, she never really knew her mother. Mm-hmm. She comes in and she's this beautiful Southern belle.
Yeah.
Everyone in town.
Nicole Kidman is just fantastic.
She's a tremendously talented actress.
Yeah.
She's also just...
gorgeous.
Yes. Commands the screen, too. Mm-hmm. Like, and she looks the part of this beautiful Southern belle.
That's what we were talking earlier when they said about Charlize Theron. We were thinking of other female actors.
Yeah, a Nicole Kidman podcast
would be
awesome.
A great podcast.
Anyone want to do that one?
Yeah. Give us credit.
Drop us a line, yeah. Make us guests. Kyle will guest on Eyes Wide Shut.
Ooh.
I'll guest on...
And then whatever the Adam Sandler one that they go to Hawaii, and she's in that, and she's married to Dave Matthews.
So yeah.
It's really weird.
I like, okay, so, like, I think her first film, Little Tangent, it was on Netflix once, and I saw it. She's, like, a skateboarder in Australia, and she's, like, a little kid, or, like, a surfer or something.
What's the famous movie that's, like, her and Tom Cruise, and that's
how they met? Days of Thunder. Right? It's her and Tom Cruise. Oh, no. Are you thinking of Eyes Wide Shut?
No. I'm thinking of...
how many Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman?
It's this Irish epic.
Oh, yeah. Fuck.
I thought that's where they met.
That's where they met. I'm thinking of Days of Thunder.
Because he was almost in this movie.
Tom Cruise?
They both went out for it and didn't know that they were going for it. And then
were they married at the time? I don't think so.
They might have been, by then, they might have been divorced.
Yeah.
And then I think he found... like, then she was like, no, I'm going for it. And he backed out.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, okay. That's cool. Yeah. No, but...
Last Samurai, also an epic.
Yes, it is. Last of the Mohegans, The Last Mohegan is white. Last Samurai, The Last Samurai is white. There's other films like this, I can't think of them.
Last of the Jedis.
Is white, and it really should be a Yoda species person, because they really pushed, you know, whatever.
Anyway.
Racism in Star Wars.
Yeah.
Or it should be frickin' Samuel Jackson.
Frickin' Calamarians.
The Calamarians don't get enough credit.
Yeah.
So we're going to be bouncing back and forth, but now that you brought in Ada, why don't we just talk about Nicole Kidman's arc? And, well, basically, of course, Jude Law is together with that. Mm-hmm. So, as we mentioned, she's a Southern belle who comes into town, and Jude Law is just kind of this aloof. He's helping build the church there.
Yeah, I work with wood.
Yeah, he's like a woodworker, but he's a little bit aloof. And they're kind of having this little, like, flirtation back and forth. Nothing ever happens.
Yeah, it's not like love at first sight by any means.
No, but what's her name? You mentioned her before, the neighbor who becomes a pivotal character.
Sally,
yes.
Yeah.
Sally's kind of like, oh, he likes you, you should talk to
him. Yeah, she's playing matchmaker.
Yeah, and so she does, and she kind of first does it to get Jude Law's character to plow Sally's field for her.
Literally.
Literally. Oh, yeah, that's not literally. I wasn't even thinking of the race. So Sally's like this older neighbor.
Yeah, and she's married to the manager of the Indians.
Yeah, eventually he becomes manager of the Indians.
Yeah.
They do a good job.
Yeah.
Leslie Snipes.
Charlie Sheen.
I forgot the third baseman's name, but he was popular at the time, but not in the 90s so much.
And the guy that's president on 24.
Yeah, yeah, plays ethnic in that film, and he's less ethnic in real life.
Yeah. Plays a Haitian.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Is he Haitian in the film? I know he does voodoo. There's no Haitian baseball players.
I don't have to tell you.
What is it? Fuck you, Juju.
Yeah.
I do it myself. He's the Allstate
Jobu,
guy, too.
Jobu.
No. But that's not what happens here.
No, that's not what happens. But, yeah, I mean,
baseball,
no, Nicole.
Podcast?
This is like a pretty strong female movie, right?
No. And we'll definitely get into that. Oh, there's so much I want to say about that in this film. So, but they're dating, not really. You know, they're like flirt. It's like Southern gentleman kind of. Like,
yes.
They're not even courting. I can't even say it like that.
No, there's just always like interactions between them.
Like flirting?
And then, yeah, just like some, like,
the root
like
beer
someone,
we mentioned.
Someone needs to take charge, and then finally he goes over there and gives her some sheet music from her.
She's a piano player.
Because she's a piano player, which, by the way, both her and, well, obviously Jack White, but, and then Brendan Gleeson as playing the fiddle, all of them. Them actually playing their instruments. There,
oh, everyone
Brendan,
actually
Brendan Gleeson
their own
is
instrument.
Supposedly very like clearly from watching the movie, but is very like a well trained fiddle.
What
player.
What a guy that guy, and he's a cool son too.
And he's in Braveheart.
He is, and Gangs of New York.
And Gangs of New York.
A lot of cool stuff. And his son's in Star Wars.
All right, I just
a lot of
good night people.
And Harry Potter.
Yeah,
both are in Harry Potter. Him and his son.
And so
I think he has one eye in Harry Potter. That's all
I
remember.
Mad-Eye Moody.
He's not mad.
I hate that. I just knew that.
That's his name?
Mad-Eye
really?
Moody.
I was like, that's not his name.
Yeah.
Oh, you should listen to our Harry Potter podcast.
Yeah. That's,
Kyle
that's
gets
literally,
the golden
I
snitch.
Think, the only. Yeah. That's like one of the few very intimate details of Harry Potter right now. And we're really going off the tracks right now. But,
we love tangents on the show. If you don't know that by now, you can leave.
Yeah.
Don't leave.
But the big thing is that Inman gives her a picture. And then she gives him a book, which is like plays an important part of his character for a bit in the movie. She gives him this book, and that's why he keeps his letters. And then she also gives him a tin picture of her in it, where she's not smiling. Because, well, famously with those, like, you have to pose for so long, it's hard to keep a smile.
Yeah.
But that just, like, wasn't... I think a lot of people just weren't as happy back then. But, yeah, so that's what happens before. And they share a passionate kiss before they go, but it's
a passionate kiss.
I don't know.
Like it's something you'd remember before going to war. That's
of course, mean. Especially back then. Like, you know, it's not too many people in town, and
absolutely
fond memories.
Jude Law's off to war. We've gone over. He's in this Battle of the Crater, and he has a subsequent battle after. Basically, they tell, oh, these Cold Mountain boys are really good.
Yeah,
can you go shoot some more Union people? And in this battle, basically every Cold Mountain boy dies, except
even my main Indian man.
Yeah, this this random
with his war cries and his big knife.
He kind of like wastes guns at one point. I don't know if you see.
He's throwing them as spears.
Yeah, why just throw the bayonet? Like, I don't know. Regardless, but everyone basically from Cold Mountain dies, and Jude Law just gets seriously injured.
Yeah, shot in the neck. Yeah.
We'll return to Jude Law because I want to go over Nicole Kidman's arc for a little bit, and then because Jude Law's arc is going to be our main focus because it has to do with Philip Seymour Hoffman's arc. Yeah. So Nicole Kidman essentially lives with her father. All the men are gone, and her father, Donald Sutherland, ends up passing away.
Yes, and so she grew up in Charleston. She was not a true Southern lady. Yeah, not that they were the wealthiest of the wealth, but still, just women back then. She never learned any kind of thing of, you know. She says, "Oh, I can embroider. I can put flowers together." But when she's like working with Ruby and like, you know, the fields and stuff like that. She's like, she has her big moment of they're putting a fence together, and she's like, oh, this is the first thing that I'll create that'll actually have a purpose.
Yeah, and that's something that's so, like you said, there's a strong female characters in this film.
Yeah.
It passes the Bechdel test. It does, because they don't just talk about the guy. They talk about doing shit and getting shit done. And all the men are gone, and her father's dead. And they have a nice house in town. Yeah. They have probably the nicest house in town with a lot of land, and it is falling apart. She's forced to forage, essentially. She's forced to sell her things, a lot of her things, and she's hoping that Jude Law is going to come back, but, like, who the hell knows? They only met briefly. They only, like, flirted briefly.
Yeah.
And she's forced to break this, what society has deemed her as, a dainty Southern belle, and she's forced to throw off that veneer and just not even be a woman, be a human being.
Yeah.
Because she just has to survive.
Yeah, first through the help of her neighbors, Sally and Esco, they're trying to make sure that she's okay, and they're knocking on her door and leaving some food for her. But then Sally ends up sending over Ruby.
Ruby, who's just like, essentially,
she really is, I should have written it down, sorry. But she has a repeating line of, that's ironic. Her line of Inman's is that how Ada is just repeating stuff back to her. And at that moment, I'm like, oh, this is the female version of Inman. Like, she found, like, a new, you know, like, a new version of him. And they just start, at first, she's like, I'm not going to be your servant.
Yeah, yeah. Ruby just is, like, rough around the edges. And she's obviously
sent there. No filter Ruby.
And she's obviously sent there because she has no hope either.
Mm-hmm.
People don't have any hope. This is like, first of all, it's not easy living in, like, the backwoods as it is.
And supposedly she grew up more in the mountains. And it ends up that Brendan Gleeson is her father, but we meet him earlier in the movie because he's playing music for Lucas Black's character.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't even remember that.
Yeah.
But Ruby is more like very country, very knows, because she's a survivor. She's never had the veneer of having to be a Southern belle, having to be like a lady that. Her mother wasn't really in the picture. Her father was a drunk. And why is she going to this plantation? Not, like, honestly, not to be nice and not to help out, because she needs to survive, too.
Yeah, she's not looking being paid. Yeah, she says that she's wants a roof over her head and she wants meals. They're going to sit at the same table. She's just setting the ground rules right there.
And can Nicole Kidman say no at this point? No. I mean, and not that she would. And these two women, I'll tell you, like, in an age where women are kind of treated like shit, not as bad as the slaves, but they're treated very poorly. These women have to survive, so they just do all these things that the men usually traditionally are expected to do, and they bring this plantation back to life. She's funny, and she's awesome.
And you can sympathize with her. It's just a great character.
And they make an awesome team. There's a little, at the beginning, of course, there's a little bit of, like, weirdness between them, but they end up making an amazing team, and the farm ends up coming back together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I guess, this is a good place to jump back to Jude Law, I think.
All the Cold Mountain boys, except for Jude Law, are killed. Jude Law gets a really bad neck wound, and he's in this hospital, and he ends up deciding that it's just better for him to just leave there.
Because Ada's letter inspires him.
Yeah.
She's just like, just leave it, just come back to me.
Yeah.
You know, and he's just like,
and so
fuck
he decides,
it.
Knowing that it's not good and, like, you know, really nothing good can come from it. He decides
seeing his Ada. So, yeah.
But. Yeah. But he decides to desert, and he starts his long journey home. And at this moment, right after kind of when Ruby is introduced to us, we end up, Inman is traveling along, he runs into Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah, about like 50 minutes in, I believe. 5-0.
52,
great.
Almost 53 minutes in. And so, does Philip Seymour Hoffman's character have a... He's a minister, right? So he's
yeah, he's a minister. And we see him, and he has...
Reverend V.C.
Reverend V.C. He's not really mentioned in the film, but he's a minister. He's got long hair. Mm-hmm. And he has this...
Great voice.
Oh, great voice. Great accent. Mm-hmm. Our man brings it here. Now, look, this is an ensemble piece. Is it his film? No. I'm not going to even say he steals the show. But he definitely brings it.
Yeah, so he's on this... Inman runs into him, and he's holding in his arms this African-American lady that we learn is, obviously down there is a slave, and that he is married and also impregnated this slave, and so she's carrying his bastard child, so he drugged her.
Yeah, I mean, he's not a good guy.
Not a good guy. Definitely not, you know, like as Jude Law says multiple times, like not spreading the good word of...
No. He's a false prophet. He's like not... He pretends he's a godly man. He is not a godly man.
No.
Because like you said, he drugs this girl and he's going to drown her because she has this baby in her.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Heavy.
So yeah, and then after this scene with Philip Seymour Hoffman, really the next scene with Jude Law is another one with Philip Seymour Hoffman where he's going along and it actually first runs into some slaves.
Right? I was a little afraid. By the way, we didn't address this. Had you seen this film before?
Yes.
I'd seen it, but it was a while. And I couldn't remember Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. And so we get that first scene, and they don't, like, join up together or anything.
No, Jude Law ties him up.
Yeah.
And puts a note above his head. We can't read it, but we assume that he's letting the people of the town know.
Yeah, like, what exactly
happened.
Yeah,
what went down.
And I was like, oh my God, is Philip Seymour Hoffman only in this scene? And I'm thinking, maybe he just did it as a favor to the director. I mean, this is one of, like, Talented Mr. Ripley is one of the first films he did.
Yeah.
Thank God he does come back. Not that he's a good guy, but...
Inman is on the run, running through fields, and then he's in these swamps, and then he comes across the Reverend, the minister, again, and he's like, I can get you out of here, but we'll play the clip for you right now.
Yeah, let's play this clip.
I can get you out of here. I dare say that's Home Guard following you. They're out on the road.
Hunting down deserters.
And I don't recommend that way. You'll meet half the town coming after me with a noose. Thanks to you.
I should have shot you when I had the chance.
I know where there's a ferry crossing. Or you can stubborn yourself to death.
If this is a trap.
Please yourself. I'm just being a Christian. $5?
For $5, I wouldn't give parched man a dipper of this river water.
John says ferry $5.
Nobody crossed these waters unless they're running from someplace. You want to wait for your friends?
I could give you $30, Confederate.
Well, all right, let's go.
Whatever that's worth.
They cut off my hair. That was hard. I was vain about my hair. I had curls. But I deserved it. I'm the Reverend BZ. Have I seen you in church?
No, not like a tornado. I'd say these days, the devil rules the rooster.
$30 more, we can go to that cabin. I can pull this dress over my head.
Have we got $30?
Get down! Get back here, blood!
So, first off, I appreciate this clip because Philip Seymour Hoffman goes into detail with the Jenna Malone character of how he used to have, you know, beautiful curls of hair. And I don't know if this has been brought up before in the podcast, but I used to have long hair, and I actually once lost best hair.
You lost the contest, the superlative for best hair.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, you also lost the hair for this same reason. The townsfolk cut it off.
The townsfolk cut it off, yeah.
Because you were a bad preacher.
Mm-hmm. But, so, I heard it in his voice. I as one man that lost his long hair, not lost, I decided to cut it off myself, but one man that used to have beautiful long hair to another man that had beautiful hair, or believed he had beautiful hair, I really felt what Philip Seymour Hoffman was selling in this scene. But then it is, his character really does have like some, besides his first introduction, which is very dark, he brings humor to this movie. And so that's a great moment, and they're crossing that river, and then unfortunately the men that were chasing after Inman finally see, and they kind of just like fire off right away and kill the innocent character.
Yeah, so she's
a young girl that's a ferryman.
She's a ferry operator, but also a prostitute.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I actually like that aspect of it, because it just showed how desperate the South was during this time of war. People didn't get some kind of money.
I think just like any people that were just like cut off from like any, you know.
But especially in a time of war when trade has been cut off.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Think about it like on a larger scale. There's nothing, it has to do with the movie, but it's not mentioned in the movie. The Union has blockaded the South for 3 or 4 years now. No imports are coming in and out. Everything you get is from off the land. And if you can't get something off the land, you just got to get money somehow to survive.
Yeah, because even what, it's supposed to be $5 to cross the river, and she's like, I know that you'll have to give me more because I hear the people chasing after you, so he gives her
30. It's Confederate, but it's still a lot of money.
Yeah.
It's probably like a couple hundred dollars. And then she says for 30 more, she'll take off her dress. But then she gets shot.
So.
Not laughing at that, but you know what I mean. Yeah, so they end up making it, escaping.
Yeah, for a while they become these traveling companions.
And then I guess the biggest comedy moment for Philip Seymour Hoffman is the fact that he's incredibly constipated.
Yeah. So that's
it's a little funny.
So as I can sympathize with him with the hair, I cannot fortunately so sympathize with the constipation. Hasn't happened to me yet in my life. And
I don't think we needed that
information. But I did write this down. I love his description of him. He puts turds on top of turds.
He's a bad, bad man, but he's still funny.
Yeah.
Because it seemed like he was going to take the ferry woman up on her offer. He was going to be excited about it.
Yeah, he's very sexually...
I guess that's his sin,
that's his
vice.
Yeah. Between the slave and then Gentleman's ferry woman and then in Giovanni Ribisi's cabin.
Yeah, yeah, and we'll definitely get to that. Actually, we should probably play that clip because he finds a saw. Because they have nothing, and they're just basically, taking stuff.
Yeah, at that moment, Inman's trying to catch a fish with his bare hands in the river, and then they hear horses coming, so they duck down. And, yeah, we'll play the clip, and it's the famous saw clip.
Is it famous?
I mean, the Fandango decided
to. Hey! Shh! Look at this!
Keep your voice down!
Look at this! It's a good saw!
And it's not yours.
You're a Christian. Don't you know your commandments?
Yeah, you'll find the good Lord very flexible on the subject of property. We can do a lot with this saw. Cut down a tree. Play music with it. You're gonna thank me for this saw.
Say thank you when I've lost you and I've found some food.
You'll see. You'll thank me.
Thank you.
here.
My old bull wandered off and died in this here creek. Poisoned up our waters, how I found him.
Thank you.
You're a true Christian. That's a rank odor from that animal.
Been dead a good while, I reckon.
This is a tricky one.
You fellas help me out, my woman cooked you up a good dinner.
I'm getting an idea. My saw's a remedy. I believe you need two people. And one on either end.
Yeah. Give me that saw. Let's do this in chapters.
That's right.
Yeah.
Start at the neck. Oh, well, that is unpleasant.
I love his little description. It almost goes into Forrest Gump territory of, like, you know, when he's just like different kinds of shrimp. He's like, things we can do with this saw. And then they stumble upon Giovanni Ribisi, who's in this, like, a little creek where his bull has died. And right away, as you heard, Philip Seymour Hoffman just kind of, like, meanders down there. Good afternoon to you, sir. You know what he kind of reminded me of in his, like, open and, like, confidence? A character from another movie. He was not his character, but, like, Walter from Big Lebowski.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When the guy was like, and a good day to you, sir. But after this scene, it gets almost to, like, did you feel, it was like a Caligula level.
What do you, oh, okay. Yes. Just in general, in real life probably, but definitely in films, when sexual times come that easy, probably think there's something behind it.
Yeah, right? something's a brewing.
So Philip Seymour Hoffman finally gets the poop.
Yes.
I mean, we should say that first.
Yes.
And Giovanni Ribisi just invites him, hey, come to my house. By the way, I hope you don't mind. There's a lot of women here.
Yeah, so it's his wife and then his wife's three sisters, I believe.
Yeah.
Because, and a bunch of children, too.
I mean, they get that cow out of the water.
Well, they cut it up with the saw.
And it's just like, it looks like it's just being hospitable.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what to think here, but like then...
I just didn't trust it.
Is
there any movie you've ever trusted Giovanni Ribisi in? I don't even care if he is good and he's the medic and he dies in Saving Private Ryan. There was just something I didn't trust about it.
Gone in 60 Seconds, Cage Club. He's like a brother who really screws up.
Yeah.
In Friends. I'm trying to think of other things he's in.
He doesn't look like a trustworthy
guy. He's in one of your
Avatar.
Yeah, it was like one of your favorite films, Avatar.
It was just confirmed via the interwebs the other day that he'll be in all four Avatar
sequels. Wow. So he's like the main bad.
Yeah.
Unless he turns good at some point.
Well, supposedly the bad guy that died in the first one's coming back too.
What? Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah. Whatever. You can do that on your Avatar
Speaking
podcast.
Speaking of Pocahontas and Ferngully. But yeah, they get to this house, and I guess they had a lot of, is that moonshine? Like, they're not drugged. They're just
really they're just drinking.
Alcohol.
And you know what it also kind of reminded me of here? Okay, so, this is a weird reference, but Harold and Kumar go to White Castle.
I was just thinking.
You know, where the guy who ends up being like, what's his name from Law and Order? I can't remember. That freak show is the character's name, but God, I love this guy, and I can't think of his name. Regardless, and he's, like, slips in, like, oh, fuck my wife, and, like,
something's up.
But it turns out nothing was up in that film. But he essentially is, like, too easy, like, oh, by the way, I gotta go. First of all, things are already starting at the dinner table, and there's, like, kids running around.
Yeah.
And there's, like, a lot of sexual energy.
Yeah, and the heavier sister is, like, rubbing Philip Seymour Hoffman's crotch.
And Giovanni Ribisi is just like, oh, by the way, I'll be back in, like, 2 days. I gotta go check some traps.
Yeah.
See you later. At that point, I would be like, what? Yeah, no.
But they were really drunk.
And
couldn't.
Jude Law handles it much better.
Yeah.
Because one of the sisters is on him in a sexual position, and the wife of Giovanni Ribisi,
who's played by Melora Walters, who is a Philip Seymour Hoffman collaborator in Boogie Nights and Magnolia.
Yeah. Philip Seymour Hoffman, though, our guy is like...
They go to the barn and just start.
Yeah, he's having like an orgy, essentially, with
again,
three or four of the other sisters. At that point, you know, a guy with a vice like that, you know he's not going to stop.
No. Home Guard, is that like, was that a frequent use for like people that collected runaways? And
yeah, the Home Guard is just like, again, like, there's no police back then, too. Mm-hmm. It's just like army soldiers trusted with taking care of. But they're not really in the army. They're kind of like a loose thing.
Yeah.
A lot of the reason they capture runaway slaves and deserters is for the money.
For the money, yeah. Which is what happens here is that Giovanni Ribisi is getting a little bit of their cut of the Home Guard. And so they come in and...
It's a trap.
Again, to quote the Calamarians. And... First Jude Law, and then they go into the barn, and we see like the three sisters just like all over Philip Seymour Hoffman. He's like, "Oh, hello, gentlemen."
It's funny because yes, this is a trap. Yes, it's Giovanni Ribisi, and these kids who are watching this trap go down—that's mm-hmm. creepy. But it's like these women who I guess are alone. They're probably widows or something.
Yeah,
they also seem like they're enjoying this situation way too much, you know.
Yeah,
they're not. And even when he comes in, Giovanni Ribisi, with like the Home Guard to arrest them, because as we said, it is a trap. He's like angry that his wife took part in it.
Yeah,
he's like, you know, you're not supposed to.
Yeah, he hits her and then hits him and then yeah.
Yeah, and to be fair, Jude Law didn't really do anything.
No, she every anything he technically did, it's like she put his hand on that area.
Yeah, yeah, no, he was like reluctant because you know he's our love interest here, but Philip Seymour Hoffman, no, he was all in. Mm-hmm. He was all in.
And so from here, they're captured by this Home Guard, and then when they're on the road, all of a sudden they hear this Union cavalry coming, and they decide to hide in like on the hill in the grass, but Jude Law. Tells the Philip Seymour Hoffman and these probably like at least like four other guys that they're in chains with that they should make a run for it, but pretty much it becomes a bloodbath and all the Home Guard that they're with gets shot, all the guys that he's chained together get shot and killed, some Union guys get killed as well, and he's just thought to be dead in this pile. Like that's a big thing with, like, Inman is just, like, it's so many close calls with him.
But it's just something that's a theme of the film.
Yeah.
People allude a lot to fate, and I want to address this in a second, but we also get a vision in the film.
Yeah.
But let's address the elephant in the room, our guy Philip Seymour Hoffman's death here.
Yeah.
Another death. Not as dramatic.
Gets shot in the... back or slash head.
Yeah, and it's like a one-shot clean deal.
Yeah.
How many deaths do we have now?
I think we did include this in, but I think at this point it's I think it's six deaths.
Six times he's died on screen, I guess. Yeah, so what did you think of his performance, I guess, in this film?
So with this, I mean, he just, again, brings so much like it to this little role, which this film, so we've discussed it before. Clearly, like he's a guy that has been in these smaller performances, but adds a lot to it. This film, though, has a lot of that from other people as well. Like soon, a scene that we're going to talk about is with Natalie Portman.
Yeah,
and you have that again. Like in like as far as screen time goes, I think he's pretty equal with Natalie Portman. He's equal with Donald Sutherland, and you have a lot of these actors that are just bringing their A game and to this sprawling epic are making the most of what they're, you know, given as far as lines and what they can contribute to just the overall story. And so for that, again, he is incredibly successful that he's funny, but then brings like, so he's obviously wasn't fighting. He was a minister, but he just brings like, you know, even if you're not in war, bad things are going on. Like, you know, there's so many times, so many different characters say, like, the world is a terrible, terrible place, and there's always these little moments of hope that are shown in the movie.
Yeah. I definitely agree with everything you're saying. I'm not upset because there's so many great actors who take these little roles in this film mm-hmm. and do a great job, and he does an amazing job. I think the way we're viewing things, movie by movie, film by film, it feels like a little bit of a step back from like Owen Mahoney, the last film we did.
Yeah, he was the star. Yeah.
But when you look at his whole career, it's not that big of a deal. And it reminds me of something that, if you guys haven't heard, shameless plug, but the Amos Poe episode was amazing that we did. But something that Amos said, I kind of brought up that Philip Seymour Hoffman paid his dues. And he corrected me, and he said he didn't believe that at all. He believed more that he was just a working man's actor. And he would just take parts that he loved. And
he just loved to act, loved to work, and loved he would to participate work on. In films.
And, I guess, and then I thought about it, and I think he's right, because we see him in later films take on similar roles to this.
Yeah, so, I mean, this, we've got a director, we don't know the exact situation, but most likely I'd say that Anthony Minghella, like, reached out to him and said, like, oh, I'm working on another, because this is the first thing he was working on since.
Oh, really? Wow, he didn't do anything in between.
No, so it's, well, that was nine, so this was... Well, actually, that kind of makes sense.
Over the how long he took.
He was involved in it for 5 years. So after Talented to Mr. Ripley, which is 1999, this came out in 2003. So even then, he was...
That's a good point.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think of, like, for example, Moneyball, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even want to get into Long Came Polly or, like, comedy things, but, like, Moneyball. Not a big party place in that film.
No.
It's more, it's not even really an ensemble film, but it is a little bit. But he still liked to gravitate to certain roles. Mm-hmm. And I think this is exactly what we're seeing here. Like, a director he likes, he's worked with before.
Yes.
Probably feels he owes a little bit too.
And that's what Moneyball again was too, because that was Capote.
Yeah.
So.
Same director, Bennett Miller. And he just said, this is an awesome role. It's a character, a dark character, a lot of depth, but also a character you could bring
against someone with a vice.
Yeah, with a vice.
We had gambling last week.
He's definitely like somewhat of a sex addict. And in that way, he brings it. When you view his career more of him taking roles he wants to take,
mm-hmm.
I'm completely happy with this, and I think it's awesome.
Really insightful information that Amos gave.
Absolutely. And if it was
You said you were guilty, or he corrected you. Like, I had said that plenty of times as well.
Oh, yeah, we both said it. It's just paying your dues thing. Yeah. And it's not that. When you don't view it as that. I think at the beginning, he paid his dues in terms of he could only get those kind of roles.
Yeah.
But I think we see that he still takes them.
Some actor that's like, no, I starred in this. I'm waiting for my next star.
Yeah, and he's an actor's actor.
Yeah.
He's a working man's actor. And though we get an early exit, how many, not even screen time, because it's not a lot, but what minute does he die? Like 113, 115, something like that. So if anything in this epic, he's only in it for 20 minutes or so. Like, and not in it for 20 minutes, just like 20 minutes of the film exists that he's alive.
Yeah.
But he's a memorable character, he brings it, and he does a great job.
Yeah, I mean, that's all you can ask from him in this role, and just as many performances that he's given up to this point, and will keep giving us.
Yeah. So, this being a Philip Seymour Hoffman podcast, we're going to try our best to bring it home.
Yeah.
The rest of the film. There's a lot of the film left, but we'll do our best to make it quick because we know you're here for the Hoff.
Yeah, so like I said, the next big thing is that Teague and his I wrote down posse, but then I corrected myself.
So Teague is Ray Winstone.
Ray Winstone.
Who's the head of the home guard.
Yeah.
In Cold Mountain.
Yeah. So he goes, and there was a rumor that Esco and Sally were hiding, they had three sons, that they were hiding at least one, if not multiple, sons back at their farm. And so Teague goes over there and kills Esco and kills their sons that were hiding in the barn, and then hurts Sally, like, really bad, like, her hands, and she ends up losing her voice from the strangling of the ropes. So that's, like, what happened on the home front. And then Inman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, just one thing I want to mention, though, because I alluded to it. So in an earlier scene, like, they act like the well is magic, or I guess it is magic to them.
Yeah.
And Nicole Kidman looks in a mirror in the well, and she sees this vision of Inman, like, approaching her with crows around her, and she doesn't know if it's a ghost or him coming back. And I just mentioned it because later in the film it is cited and is an important thing.
Of course.
And foreshadowing, if you will, but very direct foreshadowing.
Then as far as Inman's journey goes, he's saved by this woman that's, like, living in the mountains in this little cabin with her goats, and she finds him in the pile of the people that he was in the chain gang with. After that is when we meet again Brendan Gleeson's character. I do not know how to pronounce his, even though they say it, I can't recall how to, it's Storbord, like Storbord. It's like Storbord.
I don't know. He's
Storbord Thews.
He's a Renee Zellweger's father.
Yes. So he's caught on Ada's property in, like, this corn hutch. Like, we have two characters with their hands.
They,
like,
set a trap.
Yeah, they set a trap. And so he's comes back into Ruby's life. We also, through him, meet Pengel, which is Ethan Suplee's character, and Georgia, which is Jack White's character.
Yeah, he has, like, a band.
Yeah, he plays the fiddle, Ethan Suplee plays the banjo, and Jack White sings, and, or they all sing, but I think Jack White plays some kind of guitar, because he's Jack White. And while this is going on, Inman leaves. And this was one of the more tender moments of the movie for me, was that he comes across this cabin, knocks on the door, and says that he's a Confederate soldier on furlough, and that he needs money and shelter, and Natalie Portman is in there with her infant son, and we learn that her husband died at Gettysburg, and so she, you know, is nervous, has a, you know, rifle or shotgun pointed at him, but he, you know, shows that he's a good guy and offers her his pistol, and so he goes to stay in this, like, little hutch, but then she is just so missing her husband that she invites him inside and doesn't want anything sexual to happen, but she just wants his body, like,
a good
next
cuddle,
to her. Good cuddle. I mean, God knows I can appreciate a good cuddle. And
we're cuddling while doing this podcast right now.
That just felt really awkward. But, I mean, we were.
I'm sorry.
I want you to tell everybody.
I'm Big Spoon.
Cider and cuddles. The two seasons.
Anyway.
Yeah. So, I mean, what did you think of this scene? It was because, I mean, it becomes a big moment, and we get our, like, one last, like, kind of cameo in this movie.
Yeah, which is, it's super interesting. I definitely want you to go into that. No, I mean, I liked it because it also showed, like, there's just so many widows in war, especially back then.
And we have to remember, again, like, this isn't, like, you know, Nicole Kidman left Charleston, and even Charleston back then obviously wasn't, you know, it was still sprawling and it was more dense, but this is, like, the mountains.
Yeah.
You have this woman played by Natalie Portman, and her infant baby has, like, a bad cough, he's sick. Again, husband died at Gettysburg, and she's all alone in this world. Like, what is, like, that's actually, that's like
legit
one of the,
all
the, like, the final, like, one of my final thoughts of this movie is just like, yeah, but what about Natalie Portman? Like, because
they take, okay, so set up what happens here, because I do want to go into this scene.
So they spend the night in the same bed just for comfort. She starts sobbing. He says, I can leave. She's like, no, I want you to stay. So they just,
yeah,
you know,
she,
in,
she
in one
her husband.
In one another's embrace, like, they're just comforting one another. And he
both miss
her,
their significant other.
Yeah, he explains how he has love in his life. And then the next morning, he's woken up by her because there's three Union soldiers outside. So he sneaks out the back window and goes up this hill and is watching what's going on while he's kind of putting his clothes on. These guys, these Union soldiers, they're just the worst of the worst. They're some of the worst characters in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I forgive them a little. And okay, no. I want to be clear. I do not forgive their actions.
Uh-huh.
But I know where they're coming from. They're in the South. These people are their enemies. They hate them all.
Yeah.
This is what war does to people. And it's not forgiving it because it's terrible. They are terrible people. You're right. They're some of the worst characters, but they're just, war makes you see your enemy as almost subhuman.
Well, yeah, they take her baby, they just put it on the ground outside while it's crying away. She's saying it's sick, please help him. And two out of the three soldiers go inside to have their way with her. Well, one at first, and so that's when we see that while this stuff was happening outside, Inman goes back inside and is hiding behind the door, and while the one Union soldier is on top of Natalie Portman lifting up her dress, Inman goes behind him and slits his throat. When the other one comes inside and it looks like the guy is just on top of her, he goes behind him and throws an axe in his back. And there's, out of the three, there seems to be like one decent guy that like was worried about the baby and he's about to pick him up, and Inman tells him to freeze, and we see, well, we kind of saw it before, but it's played by Cillian Murphy, who is known for his breakout role in 28 Weeks Later, and then played the Scarecrow in all three Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, also Dark Knight Inception.
Trilogy. Inception. And so, yeah, just a small role for him in back in 2003. And Inman just wants him to take off his clothes, and he starts running off, but then Natalie Portman steps out, and pretty awesome shot with the rifle.
Yeah, boom, point. Not point blank, but like...
Yeah, like from a distance, just yeah. Lays him out
in the back,
and that's the last we see of her character. So I went like, what? I kind of wanted like him to be like, "There's a good town, Cold Mountain. Like you should move to it." Like no, I wanted again, to see her like at the end of the movie when they're all around the picnic table. I wanted to see her there with her boy.
I think she'll be okay. She's a survivor, and they didn't take the hog.
Yeah,
she said the hog will help her survive the winter. I think she'll be okay.
Yeah, but I'm just
also like. We should.
She does need to move, though. She'll be fine. Like,
I don't know. It's funny, not funny, but it's interesting, right? Like, there's snow on the ground, but this is the South, and I know it's
mountains
snows.
In North Carolina.
Yeah, in the mountains in North Carolina, I'm sure, but I'm not used to hearing that accent in a snow-covered land. If that makes sense, you know, I'm used to hearing like molasses down by like the cranberry bog,
the
or whatever,
yeah.
Or the creek.
The cranberry bog.
You know, so
don't go onto the briar patch.
yeah, that's what you're like. Yeah, don't go into the briar patch. Songs of the South. That's originally from a banned Disney film.
Yeah, yeah.
I've never seen it. But I've only seen like the Zippity-Doo duck.
Yeah.
That's it. I don't think
that's it because that's all you can show is a black man singing Zippity-Doo-Dah to a couple of animated birds.
I wonder how bad it is. Like, I really want to see Songs of the South.
It's got to be out there somewhere.
It for them to ban it, it has to be pretty, like, something has to be really bad. Because this wasn't banned recently.
Well, because that's nothing like, but, like, feel-good stuff, but clearly when they
say,
like...
Yeah, probably like, oh, I'm a slave, but I love it.
Yeah, even when she says, oh, I'm going to bring the Negroes some root beer, like, even then you're just like, ugh.
Yeah.
But it's not a... But it's, like, they use it because that's what they were saying at the time, yeah. But in, like, Songs of the South with Disney, you can't say Negroes and have a cartoon bird flying over your head at the same time.
Think about it. If they allow Peter Pan to, like, still go on with, like, that whole, like... What
red
make
man.
The, yeah, what make the red man
red
song?
Yeah.
And that's okay?
Well, because that's fantasy, at least.
But,
so maybe there are different
Songs
types.
Of the South must be... Too, I don't want to know. I do. But, like, it's... Oof. Bad.
Free work is fun.
Essentially. Oh, boy. Zippity-doo-dah. Anyway,
yeah.
Back to our podcast.
Yeah, and, I mean, after this, the big moment is that Ruby's father... And then Ethan Suplee's character, so Pangle, and then Georgia, they are staying up in the mountains. Ruby isn't letting them stay at the house, and they find one of them finds this dead animal that's been frozen or whatever, and it gets Jack White's Georgia character sick, and he's in the bushes, and that's when Teague comes up with his, you know, posse. And they come around, and they sit at the fire, and they seem harmless at first. But they ask him to play some music. And also, Ethan Suplee's character is a simple-minded fella. And
is
so
he
gives,
okay, is he just, like, dumb? Or does he have a learning disability, in your mind?
In my mind, he's, like, one of those situations that's like, oh, he was kicked by a mule.
So he has some kind of learning disability.
Yeah.
He's not just, like, okay.
Yeah, like
I mean, that would make sense because he's a savant with the banjo, you know.
Yeah.
So he's like, that's his one way of truly communicating.
Yeah, of like channeling.
Yeah,
But yeah, he gives up that they were the ones, because Teague says that they heard that there were people living in the cave, and Brendan Gleeson tries to say, oh, what cave around here? And, you know, and he's just like, oh, you know what cave? Like, you know, Pangle, and he's just like, oh, we were living in that cave. And in the meantime, again, George is watching from the bushes. So Pangle and, you know, Brendan Gleeson's character, they're playing their music. It's a beautiful song. Ray Winston even starts kind of singing. He stands up and is facing away, starts singing along. And then once the song is over, he asks them to stand up, and he doesn't want them. And Pangle thinks that it's going to be for a tin photo, and he tells him not to smile. And then he tells him to put a hat over his face.
But Gleeson knows it's not.
Oh, yeah. And he says, like, Ruby didn't, you know, she wasn't, you know, like, she only gave us a jacket. She wasn't doing anything. Like, don't do anything with these women. And so they both get shot. Brendan Gleeson goes rolling down a hill. And then the next day, Georgia runs down and tells Ruby and Ada. And they go up there. And they think at first that they took her father's body.
Yeah.
But they see him, and he's still alive, but he's lost a lot of blood. So what was it? Was these, were they, did they say Cherokee? Or it was some Native American, like, cabins.
Cherokee.
And they go to these cabins, and because they wouldn't, he wouldn't make it down, back down the mountain before being mended and taking the, getting the bullet out of him. And so while he's in bed, Ruby tells Ada to go get some food, and she ends up finding some turkeys and shooting one of them. And then this is the moment.
This is our big ending, folks.
Yeah.
So finally,
and Inman meet again. And at first, she thinks it's him, but he doesn't say anything. And then he says something, but she doesn't say anything back.
Because he's got this cool beard.
Yeah. And his voice is still a little weak from getting shot in the neck. And then he turns away, but then she finally yells out his name, and he pauses there and turns around. But it's not like they go one of these movies where they go running up and they grab one another in this
which
embrace.
Honestly, I love.
Yeah, because that's not what it was. They had this one, while passionate, one kiss before he left, but they just go back to this Cherokee camp, and she introduces him to Ruby, and she's kind of nonchalant. She's like, oh, this is the guy you're talking about.
It's awkward. It's a little weird. But it's exactly what would happen if two people, when two people reunite after a while, it's not always this passionate thing.
Yeah.
It's like, he's seen a lot of shit, she's seen a lot of shit.
Yeah, and he keeps telling, he says to her, like, I don't know if, like, I'm not the same man as when I left. Like, any kindness, any sweetness, like, it's left me. Like, it left with every life that I took as well. But while they are sitting around the fire and saying that, you know, she says, oh, we only had a few moments. And he goes, no, thousands. And they start saying these moments, these beautiful moments that they remember having with one another before he left for war. Ruby comes out and pretty much, like, she's a great wing woman in this movie.
Yeah.
And says it, like, is just like, I'm going in this, you know, hut with my dad, and you can go.
I like how she is before that, though. She's very protective. Because she's heard things about this guy, but I don't think she thought she would ever come back.
Yeah.
He would ever come back.
And she's a little threatened because she's like,
yeah.
I had plans for that farm.
Yeah. She just...
That's her life now.
She doesn't know if, like, he's going to be like... All she knows... I think, did we mention this? That the father originally was abusive to her.
Abusive and drunk and just...
All she knows of men is that.
Yeah.
So she doesn't know if this guy's going to come back and be that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I think she approves of him because he seems like a legitimately nice guy. And the big thing is, like she shaves him.
Mm-hmm.
Jude Law's shaving his beard off with her knife.
And nicking himself.
And she, like, offers to shave him. And, like, I think the showing of trust, because the blade's basically on his jugular.
Yeah.
Like, where she's like, all right, this guy's pretty cool.
And so after their passionate night together, which supposedly took 2 days to shoot,
the lovemaking scene between Jude Law
scene,
and Nicole Kidman.
Yeah. Took 2 days to shoot.
By the way, Jude Law's penis is on the internet.
I didn't know that.
Yes, so he's had leaks. So if you want to see it, I just want.
To me or to the
you,
to
Kyle,
the
and everybody? I just want to be fair because we often mention nudity on this podcast.
Yeah.
And I don't want to just mention the female nudes here.
No. We see butt and we see one nipple, but it's not like... Nicole Kidman has shown everything in her career.
Yeah. So, but it's tasteful.
Yes.
It's not like...
Oh, no, it's A Very Passionate Night, which took 2 days to film. And I like this moment where I don't know if it's just him as a good... He is a good guy, but I don't know if, like, Ada said a little something to him. But before they head back, Inman says to Ruby, I think, you know, it's best to ask you, like, if I plan on staying there, are you okay with me staying at the farm? And, you know, she gives him his, you know, the okay and her blessing.
Yeah.
So that was just, like, nice. A nice moment.
It's
and
nice.
So,
but the end of nice moments, kind of. Well, there's a nice moment at the end.
But. Yeah. But Ruby agrees with Inman that she and Ada should go ahead and he'll walk down the mountain with her father on the horse. And she's kind of still, like, you know, we're like woozy and passed out from his the bullet to his back. And then when they're going back down, of course, Teague is there with his posse. And
you knew it was coming, though. You knew it was coming.
And they went down to the farm and found Georgia, and he... Well, because they beat him up, said that they were up there, and they thought it was just like they were burying the two people. I don't know what they were gonna do here, if they were gonna kill both Ruby and Ada. I mean, what did you...
I think at this point they were gonna kill the both of them, because, I mean, I don't know if we alluded to it, but Ray Winston's character at first tries to woo Ada.
Yeah, he wants the property.
And,
I mean, she's
a
attractive.
The farm. Yeah, as a way to get the farm. Yeah. But she just, like, flat out denies him every time. So he's obviously trying to, like, consolidate all the land he can at that point, gain a little power,
yeah.
And just himself survive too. Again, not forgiving him, but we're in like Mad Max rules, kind of.
Yeah, it is a very...
It's like a real life Mad Max.
Tie in to Watch the Theron.
Yes.
As I said, plans are thwarted because Inman sends the horse down, and it kind of looks like Ruby's father is riding it, although he's still injured and, you know, very much up against the horse. But while they briefly shoot at that, Inman comes out and starts shooting. I think it's at least, like, including Ray Winston, like, 5 or 6 other guys. And
a posse.
Yeah. Ruby even shoots one of them, but she gets shot in the shoulder, and then Inman tackles a guy, and Jack White is able to get up, hit one other guy, and pretty much all of them, even Teague, is finally on the ground, and Inman shoots him, kills him, but he goes riding after Charlie Hunnam's character.
Sons of Anarchy guy.
Yeah, who plays a really creepy,
albino,
like, acrobatic albino that, like, is
so
jumping off the fences.
What do they
say?
Youth is my inspiration or something like that.
Yeah.
Like,
but they have...
He's like a video game boss.
Yeah. But they it's really kind of, like, cool moment that they're just... Again, Charlie Hunnam has, like, the higher ground, but they're both, like, riding parallel with one another, and they just get into, like, a quick little shootout, and then we see Charlie Hunnam get shot, and it's just, like, leaning, like, still on the horse, but, like, leaning off to the side, clearly dead. But then Jude Law, unfortunately, starts coughing up blood.
Yeah, so...
And this is where that, as you mentioned, the well prophecy...
Yeah, so first Nicole Kidman thought, like, oh, the prophecy, or what I saw must have been him coming back. But it was actually, again, it's literally what she sees happens.
Yeah.
Right? He just...
She goes up after hearing the echo of the pistol going off and sees him off his horse, and these crows are flying through this little, like, passageway, and we see him walking through, and he collapses on his knees, and he just says, like, I made it back.
Yeah, and it's really, really sad, because this whole epic is about how much total time do you think they spent together in this film?
Yeah, I mean...
Not long, but you know what? This film should be called The Film of the Super Sperm. Because at 3 times here,
yeah,
there's, like, at least brief sexual encounters or one sexual encounters that result in children. So, Donald Sutherland, like, I don't know, maybe he knew her for a while, but it kind of implies that he wasn't even married to his wife for that long.
Okay.
And conceived Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
Even Ruby... they admit that
that
mother didn't know the father that long. And now, you know, Jude Law and Nicole Kidman had sex once, and we see later they conceive a child, a little redheaded girl.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know what it is, but maybe guys in the Civil War very good. I mean, I don't know if you want to call it good. Yeah, fertile.
Well, yeah.
When men and women are more
so
fertile
back then.
The
royal oats plowed the fields.
Regardless. So we get this nice little end coda. I keep using that word, but little end scene. And it's...
Easter.
It's Easter. They seem like they rebuilt the farm and the town. And who's at this table?
So you've got Ada and her daughter. And then you've got Sally, who is... you know, still a lot, you know, lost her husband and her sons, but she's still living at the farm. You've got Ruby and her father, and then Jack White is now her husband.
Yeah.
And
Ruby's.
Ruby's husband, and they have two children.
One big happy family.
Wanted to see Natalie Portman at the table.
She
it was Easter
there.
Sunday. She was there for Passover.
Okay. No, but again, very, very... happy ending, but bittersweet because obviously Jude Law's character has passed away. So that's our film. So you said you liked it?
Yeah, I know. I really love this film. I again, in epic fashion, it is a longer movie and it has a slow pace to it, but it's a beautiful movie. It lends itself to the genre very well. It's a fantastic ensemble. And another great performance by our main man.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So 71% Rotten Tomatoes by the critic, 77% by the audience. I think to me it's in the 80s.
Yeah.
I feel like
low
it's,
80s.
Yeah, that's fair. I feel like at least 10 more points there. At least on the critic score.
Did you happen to look up what was that year in Oscars?
Return of the King.
Yeah, I Lord always like, Rings. You know, you think the year, but then it's like the next year is like what the award ceremony is.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it was, so there you go, another epic. And you have to, I mean, sorry, Zach Bressler, our feuding of Star Wars versus Lord of the Rings will continue, but Lord of the Rings clearly won because it was like for the best of three, you know?
Yeah.
Like, but
that's a reward.
And then I'm now looking at it as well, and boy, guys, you're welcome. We're promoting the new podcast. Charlize Theron won that year.
Oh, for Monster?
For Monster.
Oh, cool, cool.
So we had Renee Zellweger. It was the year for Blondes. And Sofia Coppola won for Best Original Screenplay.
Cool. That was a cool year.
Yeah.
So, Cold Mountain. Again, I wish we saw more of our guy. I say that a lot. Mm-hmm. But still happy that we did it on this podcast. Happy that I got to see it again after, again, I might have seen it years ago. What do we have next week?
Next week we have... Are you ready, Brian?
I'm ready. What do we have? I don't remember.
Along Came Polly.
Oh, wow. A film that a lot of people talk about on this podcast. Not everyone loves, but everyone remembers Philip Seymour
easily,
Hoffman in that film.
Easily in my top five favorite performances of Philip Seymour Hoffman.
I really can't wait to watch it again. Again, we'll get into it, but it's definitely it's not the greatest film in the world.
And we're having,
but he's amazing in it.
Yeah, and we've been kind of talking about the new shows on the Cage Club Network, but we'll have more of an inside scoop with yet again our most frequent host, Michael Manzi.
Yes, the acclaimed podcaster Michael Manzi.
Yes.
So we'll get Michael Manzi on. We're gonna talk Along Came Polly. You know, we're gonna make it rain.
And he's never seen it before.
He's never seen it.
He's only seen, to quote him, the beginning and a few scenes.
Why the hell did he pick to do that podcast? I'll just say it right here. I mean, we have got so many people who have asked to be on that episode, but he's kind of our boss on the network. We have to have him on it.
Better make it good, Michael.
Yeah, you better make this good, Michael Manzi.
I know I said that a little bit like John Wayne. Better make it good, Michael.
We have a lot to say when it comes to that film.
It's going to be a this is an epic movie. Next week is going to be an epic podcast. 3 hours long.
It might be, honestly, we're going to try to like restrain ourselves, but we could probably do a 3 hour podcast.
I could do 3 hours just alone on Hank Azaria's character in that movie.
Kyle and I have talked about Along Came Polly.
Quite possibly one of the bigger reasons we even decided to do this podcast. And I'm
not
going to
lie.
Not joking.
Not going to lie, yes.
Any of you haters out there, next week, you're gonna change.
maybe not. I don't know. We'll talk about all aspects of that film. Yes. But it's definitely something where we've like gone back and forth with Along Came Polly. It's a lot of people's. I know, like my aunt, it's one of her favorite films. And it's not. I get people who don't necessarily like it, but we'll get on into all that next week. Also, check out all the other. We alluded to a lot of them today and talked about a lot of them. Check out the other great shows on the Cage Club Network, cageclub.me. Thanks so much for listening. Share, like, follow, subscribe, tell your friends, comment. Maybe next week, maybe the week after, we'll go through more of your fun comments. We've been getting some great ones.
And always, stay uncool.
Thank you.